From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Lisa Mullins in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today in Washington, Donald Trump made this pronouncement.
Hillary Clinton and her campaign of 2008 started the birther controversy. I finished it. You know what I mean. President Barack Obama was born in the United States, period. Now we all want to get back to making America strong and great again. Thank you. Thank you very much.
And now we want to get to the wisdom of our 2016 roundtable.
Here and now. 2016.
And joining us today, Jesse Holland, who covers politics for the Associated Press. Hi, Jesse.
How you doing?
Doing well. And Julie Mason is with us as well, host of Press Pool on Sirius XM. Hi, Julie.
Hey, guys.
And worth pointing out, first of all, that not only did Hillary Clinton and her campaign not start the birther issue, as Donald Trump just said, but he also did not finish the birther issue, as he just said.
He just gave it a new start, in fact.
Right. Well, and Jesse, let me start with you, your thoughts on this turnaround from Trump.
Yeah, it's interesting why he decided to make this move now. It's impossible to say that this is the end of the birther movement, as he tried to put it. It just seems like now that for the next couple of days, this is all we're going to be talking about. He's brought it back up again and made it part of the campaign. Even President Obama had to talk about it earlier today. So now, instead of, like he said, ending it, he's just giving it new life.
Julie, what do you think?
Yeah, he's completely perpetuating it. I'm sure we're all very, very grateful to him to putting an end to this, but he's not putting an end to it. And as you say, Hillary Clinton and her campaign was not responsible for bringing it up. It's just more of Donald Trump's misstatements, falsehoods, and we just carry on. It's quite ridiculous.
Anybody know whatever came of the evidence that Donald Trump said long ago that his investigators supposedly unearthed in Hawaii information that would prove his birther theory? I wonder if anybody's even asked about that.
Yeah, I think his investigator is living a nice life in Hawaii. That's why we've never heard from him.
Does this hurt him, though, among anybody when he comes out and says, actually, all those things I said about President Obama not being born in the U.S., now I believe he was?
No, you guys, right now the fight is over. There's about 30% of Americans who are either undecided, I know, completely unimaginable, but they are undecided or persuadable. And that's what this fight is about. That's what the fight is for. That's what we're on for right now, fighting over that 30%. I'm not sure how this gets him anywhere with those people.
Or this
morning. It definitely doesn't do anything as far as bringing him more minority votes, because there are a lot of people of color who take the whole birther argument as just an insult to the first black president and in a way to try to delegitimize what President Barack Obama has done over the last 8 years.
Well, in fact, Hillary Clinton weighed in on Donald Trump a little bit earlier today. It was an event that was organized by the Black Women's Agenda in Washington. Here's some of what she said.
He is feeding into the worst impulses, the bigotry and bias that lurks in our country. Barack Obama was born in America, plain and simple, and Donald Trump owes him and the American people an apology.
So this week it was also Donald Trump who accused Hillary Clinton of having a hate-filled campaign that is short on policy specifics. Again, he's turning the table there. Is it a turning point in the week and in public opinion of him?
Well, certainly we've seen the polls tighten up. Some of these battleground states are looking very close. Suddenly he does have a path to 270, but there's still time left for him to blow it.
Jesse, let's talk about Hillary Clinton, because before this birther stuff came back up, she was in the news because she was off the trail, because she had pneumonia and she was recovering from that. She didn't tell everyone that she had pneumonia when she found out that she had pneumonia. But here she is. I don't have a clip of her. I thought I did talking about this. But what do you think that did to the campaign, and did it hurt her to be off the trail?
Well, it probably didn't hurt her to be off the trail, but what may have hurt her campaign is the idea that she didn't disclose. One of the themes that the Republicans have always been pushing around Hillary Clinton is that is her honesty. And so when she seemingly had that stumble and then came out later to say that she was doing great, then they came out and said it was heat exhaustion. Then they came out and said it was pneumonia. It feeds into that idea that she's untrustworthy. Now, I don't know whether anyone actually is going to accept this argument, but it does feed into the storyline that we've seen out there about the Clinton campaign the whole time.
Well, why'd she do it then, Julie? Why didn't she just – I mean, she knows that this is a criticism mm-hmm. of her, that she doesn't come out and say what's really going on all the time. So why would she take that risk?
Well, Jeremy, you remember it was Rudy Giuliani, one of Donald Trump's surrogates, who was trying to make a big deal about Hillary Clinton's health and there's something wrong with her. And it was circulating in conservative media and on the internet. And she didn't want to feed into that by admitting that she was, in fact, getting sick on the campaign trail. So they kept it quiet. They kept it a secret. And she walked right into his trap.
She might walk right into the trap, but I wonder to what extent voters would find an equivalency from the things that she does or doesn't say about her health and the little that we know about Donald Trump's health or the other pronouncements mm-hmm. he made even today. I mean, do the two carry the same amount of weight?
Yeah, I think anyone's looking for like truth and disclosure from Donald Trump because he's such a proven liar and nobody cares. Their voters do not hold him accountable. There's no consequences for that. But people do give Hillary Clinton the benefit of taking her seriously. So often when she prevaricates or lies or is secretive, there's a consequence for her.
And what do you think about that, actually, Jesse? Do you think it's something that the media has treated as an equivalency or not?
Well, it's hard to say what this. That's more of a chicken and egg argument. It's hard to say whether the perception preceded the media coverage or did the media coverage inspire the perception. Mm-hmm. But one thing that we can say is we've gotten to the point where the two campaigns are basically accusing each other of the thing that they've been accused of before. We've heard Hillary Clinton today say something about Donald Trump not holding press conferences. We've heard Donald Trump now say something about Hillary Clinton not releasing her health. We're at the point where both campaigns are shooting the other campaign's bullets back at them. Mm-hmm. So it might be at the point where we're just going around in a circle a little bit.
Ducking.
So here's something that came up this week that, got lost in the shuffle of all the other things that were going on. But Trump referred to campaigning right here. Listen to this as performing.
It is hot. And it's always hot when I perform because the crowds are so big. These rooms were not designed for this kind of a crowd.
Now, Clinton called him a showman this week. Yesterday at the New York Economic Club, he promised an economic growth rate of more than 3.5%, which is something that hasn't happened in years. And a lot of economists would say, you know, given the size of the U.S. economy, is not going to happen no matter what you do. But Jesse, your thoughts on that, these pronouncements that he makes, these big promises that he makes. He said last week that if he had been president before 9/11, that Osama bin Laden would have died before 9/11.
It's almost to the point where it's hard to decide whether to take anything he says seriously because he seems to say so much stuff. But people are listening to him, and that's the advantage. I guess the advantage of running for president, that people listen to what you have to say and then have to make a decision on whether they're actually going to believe it or not. He's out there saying these, making these pronouncements, saying these big grandiose things, and it's getting him attention. Right now, is that what you need to compete for president? We see his polls going up in some places, so maybe what he's doing is working.
The New Hampshire Union Leader, this is historically conservative newspaper, has endorsed something it hasn't done for 100 years. It has not endorsed the Republican candidate. It's endorsed instead the Libertarian, Gary Johnson, this week. Is Johnson gaining any steam after that stumble that he made? He said it was kind of like a sort of absence of the brain for 1 second on the question on Syria and Aleppo last week. Is he picking up some of the slack that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are leaving?
No, there was a great Washington Post poll out this week that showed him pretty much stuck at 9%. He doesn't appear that he's going to make it into that first debate. And the Aleppo thing does seem to have hurt him a little bit. I mean, we've all drawn a blank on national TV, right? But we're not running for president. And that does seem to have hurt his credibility.
Jesse?
Yeah, it's hard to see any third-party candidate really having a huge effect on this race. Both sides really worry about third-party candidates drawing votes away from the main candidate. But it's hard to see a third-party candidate, either Libertarian or Green Party at this point, making a huge push and winning or even having a huge effect on the final tally of this race. So if they can't even get enough votes to get into the debate, they're going to lose steam quickly before the November elections.
Okay, we just have a few seconds left, but I just want to ask this question, and I just want a one-word, one-name answer from each of you. Who has the edge going into the first debate, Julie?
Donald Trump.
Jesse?
Hillary Clinton.
Ooh, look at that. A split decision.
Good job.
Well, Julie
just
Mason.
Just what we were hoping.
Yeah, exactly. And we'll be watching. And that is in 10 days, amazingly. Julie Mason, host of the Press Pool on Sirius XM. Thanks to you.
Thanks, guys.
And Jesse Holland, who covers politics for the Associated Press. Great having you as well, Jesse.
Thank you.
Thank you both. An update now on two stories we've been reporting on. The president of the International Olympic Committee says he's going to ask Russian authorities to help stop the hackers who managed to penetrate the database of the World Anti-Doping Agency. Then they posted medical information about some of the Olympians. That's including three American athletes, gymnast Simone Biles and tennis star Serena and Venus Williams. The Anti-Doping Agency, also known as WADA, blamed the hackers, known as Fancy Bear. That's a Russian group that experts say is behind other security breaches. WADA says it was targeted in retaliation for its investigation into a Russian state-sponsored doping program during the 2014 Sochi Olympics. And in Pittsburgh, the state agency that regulates taxis and other transportation businesses says it does not have jurisdiction over a test program now underway there. Uber is offering free trips in self-driving cars. Since the rides are free, the Public Utilities Commission says it can't regulate the program. Once Uber starts charging, though, the commission says it'll need to have proof that the rides are indeed safe. Life can seem so confusing when you're a tween in America. Multiply that at times a million when you're a tween who's just moved here from overseas, and a gazillion when you moved here from Iran. Welcome to the life of Firuzeh Dumas. She and her family moved from Iran to California when she was a preteen. That was in the 1970s.
Most Americans had actually, that we encountered, had never heard of Iran. So we spent a lot of time answering questions about camels, which was fascinating to us because I'd only seen a camel once in my life, and it was in a zoo. And, you know, I would tell people, well, no, you know, we don't ride camels. My father actually has always had a Chevrolet. But when the American hostages were taken, all of a sudden there was this anti-Iranian sentiment that just swept the nation. And in real life, I was about 13 when that happened. And I was the only kid at my school whose country had just had a revolution. So there was a lot that I could share with absolutely no one. And hence the book.
The book is called It Ain't So Awful Falafel. Dumas is a humorist and author of the best-selling book Funny in Farsi. This new novel is mostly for a younger audience. It's a story of a newcomer from Iran who goes through a lot of the misadventures that the author, Firuzeh Dumas, herself went through.
So the main character in the book is Zomorod Yousefzadeh. She changes her name to Cindy in sixth grade because, of course, nobody can pronounce Zomorod Yousefzadeh. And that is definitely based on my real life because one thing I learned as a person named Firuzeh Jazoiri living in America is that my name not only was completely unpronounceable and pretty much ended all conversations, but it also didn't fit on any forms. So I remember like getting my library card from the Whittier Public Library and writing my name really, really small on that line, and it still didn't fit. Like half of it just like went over like a waterfall. So in the book, she changes her name to Cindy, and she's just moved to Newport Beach, California, and she's starting sixth grade, and this is her chance to just fit in in an American junior high. There's a scene where Cindy goes to a neighbor's house, and this girl says, "Oh, my favorite song is Love Will Keep Us Together. Do you like that song?"
Tenille, yeah.
Cindy, who's never heard that song, says, "Oh, yeah, that's my favorite song, too." Like, I did a lot of that growing up in middle school because I just had not heard of any of these cultural references. But I always said that I had.
And it was hard, especially because your family was so Iranian. And you said everything in your house, everything on the shelves of your kitchen spoke about Iran and not about the United States.
Well, like, okay, one of the ways I never fit in, I was very conscious of this, is that when you go to someone's house after school, they always have snack foods. And you can really judge someone by the kind of snack foods they have. Like, some people had better snack foods. I still remember my friend Kristen because they always had ice cream. So at my house, we didn't have snack foods because in the Iranian culture, we don't snack. And so the only thing we had were fruit and pickling cucumbers. So this was always like a source of embarrassment for me. And I would just avoid having anyone over because I knew I did not have the correct snack foods.
At the same time, America and Americans were kind of inscrutable for you and for your family. And there was this, what you call in the book, the mystery of the friendly Americans. What was that?
Well, when we first came to America, we'd be walking down the street and somebody coming towards us would say, hello. And automatically, we'd say hello back. And then we'd spend 10 minutes going, wait, who are those people? Where do we meet them? How do they know us? And it wasn't until I finally figured out that in America, people say hello to perfect strangers. But it absolutely was like such a puzzle for us. Because, you know, when you move to America, you don't get this like guidebook on Americans. You have to figure it out yourself. And I was very happy to figure that out. And I went on to become like the most friendly American. I mean, I would say, hello, how are you? What a sunny day. Oh, isn't it lovely today? I mean, I would just have conversations with every stranger I could find.
In Southern California, it's a pretty safe bet to say it's going to be a sunny day.
Yeah, exactly. But then the good thing is when it's not a sunny day, then you really have a lot to talk about.
So you and your family would watch, especially your parents would watch TV sitcoms, a typical American pastime, but they wouldn't laugh at the same things that the laugh track was laughing at. And they were perplexed by certain things that got huge laughs here.
Absolutely. Well, you know, humor is very different from one culture to the next. And we used to always watch the Carol Burnett show. We loved Carol Burnett. But there was a lot we didn't understand. Like, she used to do this, like, Tarzan yell. We had no idea why that was funny. And our favorite, there was a show called The Flip Wilson Show. And he was just this comedic genius. And he would turn into a character named Geraldine. And we thought that was hilarious. Just seeing a man dressed up as a woman. I guess that was funny. But pretty much every other joke we didn't get. And the thing that perplexed us was just the gags like throwing a pie in someone's face. You know, when you're coming from the Middle East, like you don't waste food. And we thought, why are they throwing a pie? And why is it funny? And they should just be eating that pie. And that we never got. I still don't get why that's funny.
I'm not sure we can say why it's funny.
Yeah, maybe that's a whole nother NPR show. We'll leave that one to like Terry Gross.
So your life kind of gets better and it gets worse at the same time because you feel like you're able to assimilate. Your father's job seems to be going well. Your mother, she was having problems assimilating. Your dad said basically, you know, your mom is having trouble because it's always going to be harder for Iranians in America than for Americans in Iran because there are so few Iranians here. And you felt that acutely as things turned tumultuous in Iran, as the Shah was replaced by the Ayatollah Khomeini, as the Ayatollah banned drinking and gambling and nightclubs and demanded that women wear certain kinds of clothing, and as the Western hostages were taken in Iran. What was that like?
Well, when the hostages were taken, every night on the news, they would start with a countdown. You know, they would say like day 123, day 203. And I remember every night we would sit on the sofa. And this, I have to remind listeners, was before 24-hour news. So you actually had to wait for the evening news. So we'd sort of sit there with bated breath, hoping that this would be the one night where we would hear them say, you know, the hostages have been freed. And, you know, that situation went on for 444 days, and that is a long time. Certainly, it's a long time to be a hostage. It's a long time for their families. It's a long time for the country. It was a long time for us because our life just ended when the hostage situation started. And every day, there was just more and more of this hatred towards Iranians. And we just knew that, in a way, our life was being held hostage as well because nobody wanted to hire my father. You know, to be an Iranian man at the time in America looking for a job was an absolutely hopeless situation.
He lost his job.
And he could not find another one. So that was probably one of the hardest things I've ever gone through as a kid because my father had always worked. You know, he'd worked since he was like 14 years old. And to have him just sitting on the sofa when I came home from school, that was an incredibly difficult thing to go through. And I really feel for kids. You know, this book is about an Iranian girl in America. But a lot of it is about what it's like to have a parent who's unemployed and who can't find a job. That's difficult for any child. It doesn't matter where you're from.
Who else did you write this book for?
You know, the dedication for this book is actually the first part of the book that I wrote. And I basically say, for all the kids who don't belong, for whatever reason, this one's for you. I really just wrote this book for every person out there in middle school, because I think middle school, I don't care who you are, it is a pretty miserable experience. So I just wanted to write a book that gave kids hope, because you don't have perspective when you're 12 years old. You don't know that this too shall pass. And I wanted to write a really funny book that would teach kids some history, but that would also leave them feeling hopeful.
Well, you know, if they need a model for hopefulness, all they have to do is look at you. You have been incredibly successful.
Actually, when I was writing the book, I just felt like I was 12 years old again. And it doesn't matter that this is a work for middle grade or that it's fiction. It is still as true as I know how to be. You know, one thing I want to add is that from back when I was first published, I remember that when I would meet my readers, they would often say that they were really surprised that a book by an Iranian woman made them laugh out loud, that that was the last thing they expected. And I hope that when young adults, when middle grade students read this book, or high school kids, I hope that it widens their perception of what Iranians are like, or what women are like, or what Iranian women are like. So that would make me very happy if I expanded people's worldview just a little bit.
Firuzeh Dumas, thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Lisa.
Chicagoans are probably pretty happy today. The Cubs clinched the National League Central title last night. It's their first division title since 2008. The team did go to the playoffs last year as a wild card, but they lost to the New York Mets in the National League Championship Series. And though Cubs fans did not get to see their team win at Wrigley last night, they still got to celebrate outside later when their arch-rival St. Louis lost and gave the Cubs the crown. Go Cubs, go, they're saying. Cheryl Ray Stout is sports contributor for WBEZ. She's with us from Chicago. And Cheryl, people must be pretty happy there today.
They're tired, but they are happy because they had to wait for the San Francisco Giants to dispose of the Cardinals in order to celebrate the Cubs winning the NL Central.
Well, was that kind of bittersweet that it wasn't because the Cubs won their game last night, but because another team lost their game?
Well, yeah, kind of, sort of. But, you know, it was going to happen anyway. And in Wrigleyville, they'll celebrate no matter what. So they were still celebrating even though they had to wait a few hours. The field itself during the game was so high, tense, electric. But, you know, it was going to happen, and it finally did. And the team will celebrate today after they play the Brewers, no matter if they win or lose.
And how's it looking for going all the way to the World Series this year?
They have a lot of good components right now. You have three of the best pitchers in baseball. Two of them are Cy Young candidates, with Kyle Hendricks and with John Lester, and, of course, Jake Arrieta, who won the Cy Young last year. You also have the two top MVP candidates in the league, and that is Anthony Rizzo and Chris Bryant. They both are prolific home run hitters. They have a terrific defense. Their bullpen may be the area you wonder about, because they have a couple injured players that are coming back. So there's a lot of positives for them. They also have, in a lot of people's minds, the best manager in baseball, and Joe Maddon.
And for people who do not live in Chicago and don't follow Chicago sports as closely as people who do live in Chicago, just remind us how big of a deal it would be, because it's been more than 100 years now, right? 108?
108. We don't forget that number. It's been a long time, and people have been waiting. There's nobody alive that actually saw the last World Series. You know, in Boston, you went through it too. But so in Chicago, it's a big deal. And the way this team was built, you have to look at what Theo Epstein, who, thank you, Boston, for having him come to Chicago. He built this team in 5 years. He's made them a really solid organization, top to bottom, with the expectations, and there are high expectations, to go to the World Series.
And, you know, here in Boston, before the Red Sox won the World Series, there was a road sign that said reverse curve, and people had written reverse the curse. Now it's back to reverse curve, now that it's the curse has been reversed.
We're hoping that the Billy Goat doesn't make an appearance here in Chicago. Yeah, it's really a big deal, and you really have to take your hat off to Tom Ricketts, the owner of this team, and how he really invested money into it, invested manpower into this team. They have one of the better scouting departments. They develop their players. They have a training facility down at the Dominican. So they've done a lot of things right to get to this point.
That's Cheryl Ray Stout, who is a sports contributor for WBEZ in Chicago, where they are celebrating today. Cheryl, thank you.
You're welcome.
After Donald Trump's event in Washington this morning, he did something that has angered the reporters following him. He left the event to tour his new hotel, and the pool reporters were kept from going with him. Then they voted to pull the camera from Trump's hotel tour and not air the footage. Joining us now is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
And this comes after something that happened last night. Trump was speaking at an event in New Hampshire before his traveling press corps arrived, and then he bragged about it to the crowd. Here he is.
I have really good news for you. I just heard that the press is stuck on their airplane. They can't get here. I love it. So they're trying to get here now. They're going to be about 30 minutes late. They called us and said, could you wait? I said, absolutely not. Let's get going, right?
David, what's this all about?
Well, I think Trump is showing red meat for his supporters, being contemptuous of the press, a contempt that he shares, and at the same time showing how masterfully he can manipulate the media. In the words of CNN's Jake Tapper, rickrolling the cable networks into covering live his appearance at the old post office pavilion in downtown D.C., to saying that he would talk about the question of President Obama's birth. He issued sort of a one-word sentence saying, oh, President Obama was born in this country and sort of wanted to move on, had some endorsements from some very worthy but relatively unknown military figures, and really used it as an opportunity to advertise his new deluxe hotel, which he's opened in that old former post office building. There's no reason for the cable networks to take that live, except they thought it would show his confrontation with President Obama over this key and utterly false issue of where he was born. And yet he used it, of course, to promote his own brand and his own name. Rick rolled him again.
And what do you make of the protest by the press today saying, okay, well, if you're not going to bring us along with actual reporters who can ask you questions about what you just said, we're not going to play any of the tape of the tour of your new hotel?
I think there was a real realization that they had been had and that they had been had in essentially a commercial way to promote the business interests of this political candidate. It's one thing to promote your candidacy. It's another thing to promote your financial interests and the thing that your name is slapped up on. I think that they just decided if they weren't going to allow journalists to accompany the pool reporters and taking footage, if they were going to keep reporters at a remove of, I think, a 10 or a dozen rows to prevent Donald Trump from having to answer questions from the beat reporters covering his campaign, and also people like David Farenthold of The Washington Post, who's been holding him accountable for where his money goes and where his money comes from in terms of his own foundation, then they weren't going to play ball on this. I think that it may be that they drew the line many 2 weeks or months too late, but they were drawing a line this morning.
Well, contrast what's going on there with Donald Trump with what's going on with his vice president or his vice presidential candidate or what has gone on in the past. I want to listen here to some tape of Mike Pence talking on the House floor in Indiana. Well, actually, this may be the U.S. House floor back in 2007.
Tide of violence against journalists in Russia since the advent of the presidency of Mr. Putin is deeply troubling and ought to be troubling to anyone who cherishes the notion of a free and independent press.
So that's Pence talking about Vladimir Putin, who we know Trump has praised in recent weeks for being, quote, a stronger leader than Obama.
Yeah, so this is a very interesting contrast. Mike Pence, very conservative guy, came up as a radio talk show host to prominence, was known as sort of a decaffeinated Rush Limbaugh. And he was there on the House floor of the United States House of Representatives. And he was known as a figure very sympathetic to the press, supported certain kinds of shield law protections, and raised his voice there about oppression of journalists in Russia. And here now he has to kind of do a turn face and say and praise Vladimir Putin, the source of course, that of that threat effectively to journalists in Russia from operating in freedom and confidence that they can expose wrongdoings by, you know, billionaires or by state agencies or by powerful government officials. It's been a deadly place for a lot of journalists who have been crusading and investigative there. And he's had to praise Putin, and that's because his running mate Donald Trump sees in Putin a figure that he can lionize and try to contrast with President Obama and by linkage Hillary Clinton as well.
And what about Hillary Clinton and the way that she handled the press with her pneumonia diagnosis and not telling people what was going on at first and then having to admit it later?
You know, I've heard so much commentary from political journalists who say, you know, the real problem with this is we didn't know, but also it fits into this narrative that this already this grudging release of information. And I kind of want those political journalists to stop doing my job. That's kind of what the media guy should do, is talk about the narrative. I think it's worth knowing for not just the press but the public if this major figure, who herself would be one of the oldest people ever to hold the presidency, is sick, and if so, to what degree. I think you know, she's actually been far more forthcoming than Donald Trump in releasing all kinds of information, including his own medical record. But my goodness, if Hillary Clinton has pneumonia, let the public know it and move on. We deserve this information. We don't have to know about every little semicolon in her medical records, but we deserve a full and fair accounting of it. And that withholding of information had implications when she seemed to falter
right.
At that event. And therefore, we were worried as a nation, I think reasonably so.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thanks.
You bet.
The Bank of England has given new meaning to paying for something in plastic. It's printing some of its banknotes not on traditional paper stock, but on polymer, meaning it's now washable plastic cash. In London, with more on the new currency, is Russell Padmore, BBC business correspondent. Russell, thanks for being with us.
Lisa, good to be here.
All right. Tell us more about this new plastic cash and why the Bank of England has chosen to use it, at least for a couple of banknotes.
It's interesting that many people will say the Bank of England is starting to join the modern world. Maybe people might be wondering why America is not also opting for these polymer or plastic notes. Effectively, as you've outlined, they're durable. They last a lot longer. That also means, of course, that the cost of having these bills in circulation is less for central banks or treasuries. So you can see there are many advantages. The British have been a bit behind the curve, but I should say that Northern Ireland, where the banks are allowed to issue their own local currency, still valued in pound sterling, they've had for a while a plastic £5 note. Scotland, much the same. But the Bank of England is the traditional bank here. This new fiver, to give you the slang word for the £5 note, actually has a picture of Winston Churchill, the Second World War leader, on it. It has a quote from him: "I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears and sweat." It looks like a very British note. And of course, there are lots of advantages to plastic, not only durable, but also there are security features in the £5 note, which, according to Victoria Cleland, the chief cashier at the Bank of England, well, in her view, they're very good.
The key reason for moving to polymer is it's much more difficult to counterfeit. So we've managed to put some really whizzy security features onto the notes. One of the key advantages you get with polymer is that actually you can leave what we call a see-through window, so you can hold the note up and actually look through it. Really difficult to counterfeit, but also quite an easy thing for people to check.
Well, along with the whizzy security features, how is it for the average person to hold one of these things? Is it thicker than the average paper bill?
It doesn't feel like a normal currency note. It is something new. People are going to have to get used to it. There aren't that many of them in circulation at the moment. I've been to quite a lot of stores asking the shopkeeper if they've actually seen one. It's quite hard to track them down. I suppose, wonder if this could be a signal about the future, where cash may be a thing of the past. The future is here. Is cash really in decline? Well, there are arguments for and against that. It certainly is going to be a change in society. But Tim Halford, the head of Cardtronics, which is the largest operator of cash machines or ATMs here in the UK, is pretty bullish that he believes the fact that people are using both cash and cards means that both have a good future.
The reality of the situation, people want to use websites and mobile phones, but they also actually want to get hands on their cash that they've been working for from a cash machine. On the other side, businesses ring us up every day in the office, usually convenience stores or shops, wanting machines in their stores so they can take our money for their products and services.
And Russell Padmore, one more question. Do you carry or do you want to carry a bunch of plastic in your wallet?
Well, we're going to have no choice. Indeed, the Bank of England, by the summer of next year, is going to introduce a £10 note, which will also be made of plastic. And the traditional paper £5 note will no longer be legal tender by the middle of next year. So Britain is changing, joining the rest of the world, joining countries like Australia and New Zealand. Canada, of course, has plastic notes, as does Chile. You can see around the world, many central banks have adopted plastic notes. Britain probably behind the curve, but finally getting there.
Well, as they said in the old film The Graduate, the future is in plastics. This proves it once again. Russell Padmore, BBC business correspondent. So nice to speak with you.
Lisa, thanks.
A video about bacteria has gone viral. It's a video of bacteria evolving very quickly to be resistant to different levels of antibiotics, something that worries scientists because predictions are that by 2050, infections that can't be cured with antibiotics could kill 10 million people a year. One of the people behind the video is Michael Baim, a postdoctoral fellow at the Khashoggi Lab at Harvard Medical School. He worked on the video with Roy Khashoggi and also, by the way, went to high school with me. Michael, great to see you.
Great to see you again too, Jeremy.
And tell us exactly what you did here.
So what we ultimately did was build a 2-foot by 4-foot petri dish.
Okay.
And this video that I guess has been going around.
And we'll put it at hereandnow.org.
Great. What you see is a top view of this petri dish. And on the outside of the dish, there are two bands that have no antibiotics. And then as you move towards the center, there's increasingly much antibiotic. So that in order to spread across the plate and take up those nutrients to grow, bacteria need to evolve antibiotic resistance.
And you watch on this video, and it's incredible, the bacteria getting to the line where there's a certain level of antibiotic, and it sits there for a second, and then it evolves and mutates and figures out how to get past that.
Yeah, what happens is that most of the bacteria are very sensitive to antibiotics. And as they get to the front, there are a few mutants in that population that can survive just a little bit more. Those are able to move ahead of the rest of the bacteria and then spread out to the point where they no longer can survive. And then mutants in that population can move ahead again. And by this process of successively gaining mutations that give a little more and a little more antibiotic resistance, we end up with enormous amounts of resistance in a very, very short amount of time.
And in this case, it took, what, 11 days for the...
The video that you've seen takes 11 days, and I've run it several times since, and it's actually very consistent in how long it takes.
Is that comparable to what it would take in the real world, or is it just such a contained space that you would never move that fast?
There are a couple reasons why it would happen much, much faster here than in the real world. One of the main ones is there are a lot of bacteria there, and the plate's basically bacterial Disneyland. They have all the nutrients they need to survive and grow and no immune system trying to kill them. So you can get enormous populations that don't have to worry about all of these other factors that bacteria need to deal with in the real world. The hope is that sort of the same pathways that give resistance to antibiotics in the real world will show up in this dish and allow us to study those reproducibly and carefully in a much shorter period of time.
And figure out a way to stop them from mutating?
I mean, we can never stop bacteria from mutating. They're going to evolve no matter what we do. The hope is that if we can understand the way that they're going to evolve, we can come up with treatments that predict this, anticipate it, and hopefully avoid the evolution of more resistance to the extent possible.
Now, there's nothing new really about this idea that bacteria will evolve and mutate and become resistant. Why do you think that this video, this short video that you've done, has attracted so much attention?
I think what's so compelling about it is that you can actually see evolution as it happens. This actually originally came from a class that Tammy and Roy Khashoggi were teaching at Harvard Medical School. On evolution. And it just so happened that Roy had seen this amazing ad for the movie Contagion. Remember that from a few years ago? Where they had built a giant petri dish and made it spell out the word contagion. And so Roy and Tammy had this idea, you know, this would be a really great way to show the class what evolution looks like. And so we built this petri dish and, you know, the first time we saw it, it was incredible because we've been making these abstract models and descriptions and drawings of evolution in the past. But here it was, all of these things we've been talking about, mutation, competition, selection, literally happening right before our eyes.
Were you surprised at how quickly the bacteria evolved?
Yeah. I think there have definitely been other experiments where people have seen evolution that fast, maybe even faster. But what was really surprising was the consistency with which it happened. You know, the two sides of this plate, they don't talk to each other.
And yet they got to the middle basically at the same
exactly.
time.
They don't know that the other one's there, and yet they tie. There is sort of a race, and they get there at the same time. And we run the experiment again, and it takes the same amount of time. And I think one of the real surprises wasn't the speed, but the consistency.
Well, I encourage people to watch the video. And again, we'll put it at hereandnow.org. Michael Boehm, postdoc at the Khashoggi Lab at Harvard Medical School. He worked on this with Roee Khashoggi. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.